Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the backlash to President Trump's announcement that he was keeping U.S. troops at a base in Iraq he described as a fantastic edifice, quote, because I want to be looking a little bit at Iran, which prompted an angry response from Iraq's president, who reminded Trump the U.S. has not asked Iraq's permission, adding that we live here. An expert on Iraq, Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, joins us to discuss his article at juancole.com, Trump to keep troops in Iraq as spies on Iran, but determined to withdraw from Syria, Afghanistan. Given that the Iraqi government is dominated by pro-Iranian Shiites, in blowing America's cover story that we are in Iraq to mop up what is left of ISIS, Trump's ignorance of diplomacy and amateurism in foreign policy, combined with a racist dismissal of the local natives, is likely to make the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq more tenuous, particularly now that Trump has said our troops are there to spy on Iran, which is sure to outrage Iraqi Shiites, who might redouble their efforts to kick the U.S. military out of their country. Then we'll assess whether the growing pressure on Virginia's governor Ralph Northam to step down will eventually result in the Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax taking over, even though sexual assault allegations against him have resurfaced on a right-wing website, which Fairfax has dismissed as, quote, a totally fabricated story out of the blue. Andre Gillespie, a professor of political science and director of the Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University and the author of the forthcoming book out soon, Race and the Obama Administration, Symbols, Substance, and Hope, joins us. We'll discuss whether a Me Too moment for race relations has arrived in the midst of universal condemnation of racist images in Northam's medical school yearbook that came out as recently as 1984. Then finally, we will examine the lawsuit brought by Gavin McInnes, the founder of the Proud Boys, against the Southern Poverty Law Center for describing his former organization as a hate group. Brian Levin, the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, who previously served as associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force, joins us to discuss his forthcoming report to the nation, Hate Crimes, and how the Proud Boys have been acting as bodyguards for Roger Stone. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and is the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And he has an article at juancole.com, Trump to keep troops in Iraq as spies on Iran, but determined to withdraw from Syria, Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks, Ian.
So, Juan, is there any other explanation except that we have a complete incompetent and amateur as a president who simply doesn't understand the significance of the words that come out of a president's mouth?
Yeah, Trump doesn't play well with other children. We know this. And I'm sure that part of the reason that the United States keeps troops in Iraq is that they help keep an eye on the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps. But the main purpose of the 6,000 or so, maybe 5,000 U.S. troops in Iraq has been to help the Iraqi government mop up the remaining ISIL fighters and terrorists, and that's the grounds on which the largely Shiite government of Baghdad would agree to foreign troops on its soil. And the Iran side of U.S. intelligence gathering activities by the U.S. Army has to be remain unstated to avoid a firestorm in Iraq itself. So Trump let the cat out of the bag very dramatically, and I think it's entirely possible that it will lead to the Iraqis demanding ultimately that the U.S. withdraw, even though that's not their first desire.
Well, there is a fairly substantial U.S. intelligence and Israeli intelligence present in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish area, close to the Iranian borders, is there not?
Well, we think so. Although it is also true that the Kurds in northern Iraq are not anti-Iranian and often have good relations with Tehran on non-Kurdish issues. And so it's not clear how cooperative they always are. The U.S., when it was occupying Iraq, actually at one point arrested Iranian operatives in Erbil, who clearly had come to lobby the Kurdish leadership. So it's like Berlin in the old days. It's very murky, and you never know who you're meeting that's a spy. But it is also the case that the U.S. Went into Iraq in 2014 at the request of the Iraqi government because 40% of Iraq was lost to this radical extreme terrorist group, the ISIL, it was the only way for the U.S. to be in Iraq was to have that kind of massive threat, because the Iraqi parliament had minded Iraq being occupied by the United States. It hadn't given permission for U.S. troops to remain in Iraq and had connived at getting the U.S. out of Iraq in 2011. Everybody in the U.S. blames Obama for this, but the fact is that the Iraqis more or less kicked the U.S. out, and there wasn't much the U.S. could have done about it except to reoccupy the country militarily.
No, indeed, that was the deal that George W. Bush was forced to make with Maliki, and Obama inherited that deal. There was nothing Obama could do about it.
That's exactly right.
But the Trump's description of this base in Anbar province that the U.S. is operating out of, and which is largely built as a what do we call it? A magnificent edifice, fantastic edifice, and an incredible base. it does feel a little bit like a kid that's got a new war toy, doesn't it?
Yes, he's boasting about this U.S. base. And again, he doesn't know about or care about local Iraqi dynamics. And so the Iraqi political class was extremely offended when Trump went to Iraq and bypassed essentially Baghdad and went straight to the U.S. base, as though the Iraqis were colonial servants and this was the Indian Raj. And then they debated this for days afterwards, and Muqtada Sadr, who has emerged, the Shiite leader who has emerged as extremely powerful after the most recent elections and a kind of kingmaker in the country, his party introduced a bill to ask the U.S. to leave. And, you know, the Iraqis were traumatized by the rise of ISIL. The Shiites really felt themselves in danger of being genocided. And so they still, I think, would like to have the help of the United States to ensure that the group is totally defeated and doesn't come back, because it still does have enclaves in northern Iraq and conducts terrorist operations, even in Shiite cities like Karbala. But having Trump parade around his kind of imperial trappings and visiting the base without visiting the prime minister of the country, and now coming out and saying that what they're really doing there is spying on Iranians. And the Iraqis don't view the Iranians the way the United States does. They have relatively warm relations with Tehran, being both Shiites. And I always thought that the U.S. calling on Iraq to cut off relations with Iran was rather like calling on the Irish to cut off relations with the Vatican. I mean, people in the United States don't understand the fellow feeling that's between the two.
And again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and is the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And he has an article at juancole.com, Trump to keep troops in Iraq as spies on Iran, but determined to withdraw from Syria. Afghanistan. And haven't the Iraqis paid a pretty high price to oust ISIL from Anbar province and particularly from Raqqa?
Well, the Iraqis have paid an enormous price in loss of life among their soldiers. Their army collapsed in 2014 and had to be rebuilt. The United States played an important role in rebuilding it. But the leading edge of those troops that went against ISIL saw very hard fighting and horrific fighting, as they describe it. You know, you would go into these alleyways in a place like Mosul or Ramadi, and the ISIL guerrillas would throw themselves down from two-story buildings onto the advancing soldiers with suicide bomb belts on and just blow themselves up, sort of making themselves human grenades. And the way that survivors have told this story is that, you know, soldiers try to be brave, and if they're fighting hand-to-hand in these kind of combat situations, they try to hold their head up. But having these people come at you just viciously with these bomb belts just inspired the utmost horror in the Iraqi side. And They suffered massacres. In some instances, their troops were captured by ISIL and were just killed in the dozens. And so, yes, it was very hard fighting. It was hand-to-hand fighting in difficult situations. The U.S. gave air support, which helped, but it didn't obviate the need for sacrifice on the ground. Grand Ayatollah Sistani, the recognized leader of the Shiites in Iraq, who are 60% of the population, called upon the young men to support the national effort. And even although he had earlier been doubtful about the militia phenomenon, even I think gave his imprimatur to Shiite militias to volunteer to fight the ISIL terrorists. And in a way, I think that saved Iraq from them, because the regular army might not have been up to the task solely by itself.
So the in the interview that Trump did on CBS's Face the Nation, where he made these a lot of extraordinary remarks, among them, of course, these remarks that we're talking about, this kind of imperialist, arrogant kind of dismissal of the Iraqi natives as being irrelevant, and that the U.S. is going to use the bases that they built there to spy on Iran, which, of course, the Iranians are quite – the Iraqis are Shiites, are very pro-Iranian in general, or at least they have deep religious ties to Iran. It's all about, in the context of him withdrawing the 2,000 troops from Syria, which now he said, well, he may not do it. At least he will do it, but he won't do it so fast. And they're there to protect Israel, which is not exactly a very helpful comment, since the people in the neighborhood are not particularly pro-Israel. But if you look at the bombing, the suicide bombing that took place in Manbij, there you go, Manbij in the north near the Turkish border. That's a very strange thing. It's been attributed to ISIS or ISIL, although there was absolutely no reason for them to do it and to create a backlash so that the Americans might stay longer. There are people who would like to get the Americans out of the Turks, and they have some pretty shadowy terrorist groups that they support. What do you think happened there?
Oh, I personally think it's entirely plausible that it's ISIL. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Troops, and there are, you know, intelligence operatives from the American side there. There are civilian contractors. Mm-hmm. Apparently, you know, they're embedded among the Kurdish YPG fighters in Manbij, mm-hmm.
and giving them various kinds of intelligence and other support. And apparently they just were, they had developed poor security routines. And they stopped by this restaurant frequently and regularly and particularly liked it. And so they were operating in an extremely dangerous counter-terrorism environment as though they were in Washington, D.C. And so since people knew that they came there regularly, ISIL, who are on their last legs, they're being defeated by the U.S. And their Kurdish allies, I think took revenge. And it's a typical kind of ISIL operation. It was a suicide bombing in a restaurant. So we don't know. It's the fog of war, and sure. As you say, there are lots of murky characters out there. But I think that this would make sense as an ISIL operation because Munbij was taken away from ISIL by the Kurds and the Americans, and so there's a revenge motive.
Right, but Turkey's not happy about it. That's for sure. And they like
Turkey is also not happy about it. But as you say, it's unclear that Turkey would want to do anything that might risk the Americans doubling down and staying.
Yeah, well, that's why I wondered why the ISIL would have done it, because that would have the same effect. They certainly don't want the Americans doubling down and staying either. Well, Juan Cole, I thank you for joining us. What would you say that, just in closing, the percentages of the Iraqis deciding to boot the Americans out of Iraq because of Trump's stupid remarks?
Well, I think that the militia parties, which have entered parliament, had already been trending in that direction, and it's kind of the mainstream middle-class Shiite politicians and, you know, the prime minister, Abdul Mahdi, who would be inclined to try to keep the Americans in country in case there might be a resurgence of an ISIL threat, who needed to be convinced. But, you know, the question is, if Trump goes around saying these things, will it shift a majority of Shiites into parliament? Will they become more afraid of offending Iran than of an ISIList resurgence? And remember, the Iranians will be telling them that you don't need the Americans to fight ISIL. We'll do it for you. The Revolutionary Guards would be good at that. Sure. So I think it's a question now how long the parliament will put up with the Americans if Trump is going to position them in this way.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com and is the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And he has an article at juancole.com, Trump to keep troops in Iraq as spies on Iran, but determined to withdraw from Syria, Afghanistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the mounting pressure on Virginia's governor. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andra Gillespie, who's a professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University, where she teaches courses on American politics, race and politics, and qualitative methodology. She is the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America, and the editor of Who's Black Politics? Cases in Post-Racial Black Leadership. And she's currently working on a forthcoming book out in a few weeks about the representation of black interests in the Obama administration, entitled Race and Obama Administration, Symbols, Substance, and Hope. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andra Gillespie.
Thank you.
And Andra, obviously, Ralph Northam is in big trouble. He has been for several days. He's sort of besieged both, I think, by criticism from Democratic lawmakers and from people demonstrating in front of the governor's mansion. So how much longer can this go on? I've never seen such poor crisis management, if that's how you can describe this. And the idea that this yearbook, The Horrible Pictures, came out in 1984, not 1964. And the idea that somehow he's never seen that, you would have thought that opposition research people would have come up with that in the last election. So do you believe anything that he's said since this incident has been revealed?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I think, one, the timing of the photo and the date of 1984, I think, is a really helpful reminder that racism is a present part of U.S. history, and that when we think about some of the most egregious forms of racism, that it's not that far in our distant past. I think a lot of people, especially younger people, perhaps before 2014 and the emergence of Black Lives Matter, were, you know, very likely to view that type of racism as something of the past. And no, it's still very much a part of our present, and it still affects people today. And there are people who are implicated in those types of acts who are alive and well and relatively young today. So I think it's always important for us to be really self-reflective about how those incidents affect all of us and how we still have to deal with them and address them. As for the veracity of Governor Northam's talk, or, you know, sort of his new explanation, I personally found many problems with it. I watched the press conference with great interest. I happen to be from Virginia and from the Richmond area. I grew up not that far from where that press conference took place. And, you know, there was a lot that was really problematic about the talk. So first, it was the change of story. So on Friday night, he said he was one of the two people in the picture. And then by Saturday, he didn't know anything about the picture. And then the defense of, well, I would have remembered that blackface incident because I participated in another blackface incident, didn't do anything to kind of redeem himself in that particular picture. The other thing that was actually, you know, really troubling for a lot of people was his discussion of how hard it was to get shoe polish off your face. And so for many people, that was a revelation, and it seemed to Evans that perhaps he had put on shoe polish more than once. And so I can't get into that, but there was just a lot about his attempted defense that actually fell very flat and very short. Not to mention, you know, when he almost moonwalked and his wife had to stop him because it was completely inappropriate. And so when we think about sort of why this has become such an issue, it's become such an issue because if you have this type of damning evidence in your background, you know, there is a chance at redemption. So if he had, you know, been really honest and had admitted that this was part of his background and had actually been proactive and had talked about it and had talked about what he had learned since 1984, I think that coupled with the record of achievement that he had already attained as lieutenant governor might have made this situation a lot different. It doesn't mean that, you know, he would have still been able to win the governorship in 2017, but you can only imagine sort of what it would have looked like if he had been preemptive and had talked about this earlier, as opposed to having to react to a particular type of situation. You know, and I think that's especially true in light of the fact that he was running for governor when the tragic incidents at Charlottesville happened. And so that would have been a perfect opportunity to talk about how dangerous white supremacy is, but about how people can learn from their mistakes and how they can learn to not judge people according to their race. And he just squandered any opportunity to talk about what he had learned, even though he attempted to do that in his press conference on Saturday. And for that reason, that tone deafness, it's really hard now for Democrats, one, to be able to defend him, and that's really important for Democratic Party branding, but it's also really difficult for him to have the moral authority to want to lead the state. A lot of people don't trust him now as a result of his behavior. So to answer your question about what this means politically, you know, it seems really hard to imagine a place in which Governor Northam can be effective right now as governor, because he's now viewed as a pariah in the Democratic Party, with so many Democrats coming out and, you know, asking for his resignation. But the reality is that he hasn't done anything that could likely rise to the level of impeachment. So he hasn't committed an impeachable offense. And so he does technically have the right to stay in his office. He was duly elected by voters in the Commonwealth. And so he could keep that office. And it would be really difficult to find a legitimate reason to impeach him as a result of the revelation of this picture from 35 years ago and even that disastrous press conference. But I think what we're going to wait to see is whether or not the political pressure mounts enough so that he recognizes that he is basically, you know, in a position where he doesn't have a lot of, you know, real political capital anymore. And so he sees that as an opportunity to try to make an exit to salvage the situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Andra Gillespie, who's a professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University, where she teaches courses on American politics, race and politics, and qualitative methodology. She is the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America, and the editor of Who's Black Politics? Cases in Post-Racial Black Leadership. And she's currently working on a forthcoming book out in a few weeks about the representation of black interests in the Obama administration, entitled Race and Obama Administration, Symbols, Substance, and Hope. So this is, of course, now spread to the Lieutenant Governor, Justin Fairfax. And many people were expressing some relief that Justin Fairfax would be a good substitute for Northam, a young, dynamic, fresh face. But now he's being attacked. A conservative website, Big League Politics, on Sunday night brought forth some sexual allegations, which the Washington Post had looked into early and had not found to be substantive enough to print. So I think in the case of Northam, wasn't it a website down in Alabama that associated with Roy Moore that also brought these things out? So where does that factor in? I mean, I'm not making excuses for Northam, but the fact that Northam's deputy, who would fill his shoes if he were to leave the governorship, is already saying that these sexual assault allegations made against him are totally fabricated, and this story came out of the blue.
I don't know enough information to comment on the Justin Fairfax story. But what I will say is that, you know, the Ralph Northam story did first come to light by a right-wing website. And, you know, it came to light, you know, in a week where Governor Northam had expressed support for a bill that's actually failed in the General Assembly that would allow for late-term abortions. And he went on a radio program in the Washington, D.C. area and described the procedure in ways that some people liken to infanticide. And so people were very, very troubled by the way that he described the late-term abortion procedure. And so, you know, there would have been lots of reasons for political opponents to want to dig up dirt on Governor Northam. The issue with this is that while it was a right-wing blog that, you know, first exposed the yearbook picture, when mainstream news outlets investigated the picture, they found out that the picture was true. And so the difference here is that, you know, while people may question the motives of the original blog and why they put the story up, it turns out that there was some there to that particular story. And so the story then took on a life of its own. If you're going to pull salacious information and put it out there, and it's not something that multiple sources are able to corroborate, then I think that's an important way to help people be smart consumers of news and to understand the distinction between tabloid news and hyperbole and fake news versus something that's actually real.
So is it the case, though, that Northam is just I don't know how to describe a bad politician, or not that good politicians, if they're slick, is not necessarily a virtue. But he seems to be a very clumsy politician. And you mentioned earlier that had he been contrite from the beginning, I'm sure there would have been some forgiveness. I mean, didn't his predecessor, Governor McDonald, who was booted out on corruption charges, didn't he ask for a kind of Christian forgiveness?
Governor McDonald wasn't voted out, so in Virginia, governors serve only one consecutive term. So he never had to stand for re-election. And then he was convicted, and then the Supreme Court overturned part of that conviction by sort of looking at a certain type of law and then saying that, you know, that was unconstitutional. But I think the issue there is, you know, this probably would have been really hard to overcome. The Democrats are, you know, making a really concerted effort to maintain their perceptual standard on civil rights issues. You know, this image was troubling, and it certainly ran counter to the brand. And the fact that he never discussed it, you know, made it more troubling. I mean, you could see somebody who was, you know, a reformed racist or white supremacist, so somebody who, you know, openly admitted to harboring previous views, but then sees the error of their ways and then talks about their journey toward, reconciliation. You could see that actually, you know, being a really compelling story and a reason for people to want to kind of continue to support an elected official. But it's really hard to justify an elected official staying in office when, one, it looks like they potentially buried a story or forgot about something that they shouldn't have forgotten about, even if they do have a decent record on civil rights. And then it's especially hard to do that when you come and you very clumsily handle the reaction and the response to the story from a PR standpoint.
So I understand that they do, and you just corrected me, that governors only have one term in Virginia, but apparently there's an advantage of Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax taking over, in as much as he could serve out the current governor's, Northam's, term and then do another term. Is that right? Of his own?
Yes, that's true. That is how I understand it. And right. I think it's also important to point out that Bob McDonald was actually two governors ago. So Terry McAuliffe is the
governor
of Virginia. Yeah.
But in general, since you wrote the book about Cory Booker, the new black politician, Cory Booker, New York and Post-Racial America, and he just announced he's running for president. How much is this sort of raining on his parade?
It certainly rained on the rollout. So, I woke up Friday morning to hearing the, announcement that Booker was going to run for president. And so for the first part of the day, that dominated the news cycle. And then when the news broke of the Northam yearbook picture, then all of a sudden Booker's rollout is, you know, sort of pushed to the side, and this now becomes the dominant story of the news cycle. So, Booker used February 1st, the start of Black History Month, to try to announce his candidacy, there was a lot of symbolic importance to using February 1st as the day to roll this out. And unfortunately, he got, upstaged by another, story that was also race related, but in a very, very negative way.
So it does seem that the Democrats want this to go away, right? I mean, this is reminiscent, I think, to some extent of what happened with Senator Al Franken at the time when the Democrats were trying to stop Roy Moore, and they felt that the accusations against Al Franken undermined their case against Roy Moore, although there was no comparison between the accusations against Roy Moore, which were hideous compared to those against the senator from Minnesota, who subsequently resigned. So do you see a comparison there that this is – you mentioned, I think, earlier that there's kind of a now – or maybe you didn't mention, maybe I just read it somewhere, that there's kind of a Me Too movement evolving around race?
I would, recognize the distinctions between Me Too and, garden variety traditional American racism in the United States, though I recognize that there are intersections and recognize that they're important. And I also, just want to affirm the victims of Senator Franken. So though they were adults, you know, what they experienced was, you know, also heinous and wrong, and that was the reason why he had to why he had to be forced to resign. The issue with Northam and with Franken is that if Democrats are going to decry the indiscretions and the racism and the sexism and misogyny and abuse of Republicans, then they have to be consistent and they have to enforce the same standards for their own members as well. And so I think a lot of that is motivating what we see happening here with the Democratic Party. So, you know, if they are going to point out President Trump's racism and misogyny, they can't overlook it within their own ranks as well, and they have to be able to demonstrate that they would be willing to, you know, force one of their own elected officials out of power. You know, now, I mean, a lot of people have acknowledged, and I think that this is, you know, a very real calculation in both Minnesota and in Virginia, the replacements will be Democrats in these instances. And so that probably makes this decision easier. But there are some people who have, you know, like Kirsten Gillibrand, for instance, another presidential candidate, who made it very clear that they are attempting to be consistent. And if they're going to sort of demand the same thing of Republicans, they've got to hold themselves to the same standard, if not a higher standard.
But, Andrew Gillespie, is there some kind of silver lining here in as much as the Me Too movement was obviously overdue, but it's turned into being very powerful and some very powerful men have fallen from grace? So are we to interpret the idea that there might be a Me Too movement emerging on racial issues, not just on sexual issues? Then am I getting too optimistic here, or do you see some silver lining?
Well, I wouldn't call it Me Too. I would say that the civil rights movement continues. We knew that it was continuing with Black Lives Matter. And so I think that this is evidence of that continuance. It was continuing in the wake of people reacting and resisting the racism that they've seen in the Trump administration. And so I think it's getting a lot of attention because of those movements. I wouldn't say that they're identical to one another, but I think that there are certainly complementarities there that I think make this notable.
So in other words, racism is something you can't get away with as easily as you used to get away with.
I think people are much more vocal and much more willing to call it out. And because you have African-Americans who do hold a prominent political position, so you have Black presidential candidates. And in this case, you have not just a Black lieutenant governor who was waiting in the wings, but you also have, I mean, one of the people that folks were waiting for on Saturday to speak out was Congressman Bobby Scott. So, you know, he is a longstanding member of Congress representing parts of Central going into Eastern Virginia. And, you know, he is the senior Democrat in the Virginia congressional delegation. And so the fact that you have people of color in these positions suggests that they're going to use their power. And they are certainly being encouraged by the political climate that we're in to take a stand, right? Their constituents would be hard-pressed, you know, to continue to support them if they stood by and overlooked this kind of issue. So we see just sort of, you know, an increasing vocality about these types of issues because I think people recognize that the stakes are high and that there is blatant racism in our society and that, you know, it doesn't go away unless we speak truth to power.
Well, Andrew Gillespie, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gillespie, who's a professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University, where she teaches courses on American politics, race and politics, and qualitative methodology. She is the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark and Post-Racial America, and the editor of Who's Black Politics? Cases in Post-Racial Black Leadership. And she's currently working on a forthcoming book coming out in a few weeks about the representation of black interests in the Obama administration titled Race and the Obama Administration, Symbols, Substance, and Hope. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the lawsuit against the Southern Poverty Law Center by the founder of the Proud Boys, who have been acting as bodyguards for Roger Stone. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he's testified before Congress's Homeland and Security Subcommittees on Counterterrorism and Intelligence, and his forthcoming Report to the Nation, Hate Crimes, will be out in March. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much, and a disappointed Rams fan.
Well, I guess it was an unusual game, right? The lowest scoring in history, and I must say, even the halftime was pretty uninspiring with Maroon 5, so...
Well, luckily, I was at my ex-mother-in-law's home with my son, and I actually preferred that than to seeing the halftime show.
I see.
That's not a joke, by the way.
Well, let's turn to serious stuff. We've been talking about the Proud Boys acting as bodyguards for Roger Stone, but also the Proud Boys leader, although he's apparently resigned from the organization in November. Gavin McGinnis.
Also, the founder of Vice News, but he's no longer affiliated with it.
Right. He was an early layoff, shall we say. But
yeah.
What's going on there, though, right, with this lawsuit against the group that used to work for, Southern Poverty Law Center? Is that a publicity stunt, or is there in some substance there?
It's mostly publicity stunt. Look, a defamation suit requires that the person suing, by just a hair, show that an untruth was said that cost them monetary harm in their reputation. I don't think Gavin McGinnis is going to be able to do that. His Proud Boys have been an array of very interesting folks in public, right, at a lot of these rallies. I've run into them. They do not look like the most... stable folks in the world, you know. So they've also been implicated in crimes in New York, and they have had some dreadful things that they've said. And I think the Southern Poverty Law Center has backed up pretty much, unless there's something I don't know, every contention that they made with fact. It sounds to me like more like a cultural rant from reading this. I'm a former litigator. There wasn't a lot of fact there. It really sounded almost like a column. It seemed very Roger Stonian, and isn't that ironic, since allegedly Proud Boys provided him with security. So, apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Well, they've been doing this for some time, the Proud Boys providing security for Roger Stone. Back in March, he used the Proud Boys as security force at the Dorchester Conference, a Republican event in Oregon. And then more recently, and his court appearances in Washington, D.C., it was the Proud Boys holding up InfoWars signs, etc., as he came out and did his Nixon salute. And, of course, Representatives Mario Diaz-Balart and Devin Nunes have posed for pictures with the Proud Boys on the campaign trail. And Fox News anchor Tucker Carlson posed in the Fox Green Room with two Proud Boys and the Republican operative Roger Stone, who they were acting as bodyguards for. So I don't know, why don't these right-wingers, they call themselves Proud Boys, why aren't they proud of what they do? Why do they try and avoid or think somehow that it's illegal to call them a hate group? They do hate a lot of people, don't they? I mean...
Well, that's a really interesting word that legally is so amorphous. It's really hard to sue on being called a hate group, because one time somebody called me a hater, and they're like, well, you hate intolerance. I'm like, yeah. And they're like, well, there goes your suit. So, but the bottom line is, what I think is interesting is missed in a lot of this, is I think the Proud Boys is also a cultural statement. And I think that that's something, and I don't want to lean to McGinnis or anything, because I don't think his suit has merit. But I do see in his words a crying out for the loss of some kind of machismo culture, you know, where people can do outrageous things and aggressive things. And it's kind of like what one of my friends called a multicultural fascism at some point. In other words, as long as you're on this particular ideology which favors the West and you're into shaking it up, sometimes conflictually with people, join us. That can be a group of dangerous outcomes, as we saw in New York. And I think that we really have to be careful on one side, free association, but on the other side, when groups are continually involved in violent incidents, I think they need to be called on it. And I think at the very least, the Proud Boys have a lot of explaining to do, both with regard to hateful rhetoric and violence around their members. And I don't think they've addressed it at all. I think Gavin McGinnis tries to make it just like a bunch of frat boys who punch themselves over cereal. And they're not. And there's some serious charges that led to his leaving the group that he founded. He wouldn't do that for no reason.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and has testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence, and his forthcoming report to the nation, Hate Crimes, will be out in March. Now, the Proud Boys, you mentioned the incident in New York. That was in front of the Metropolitan Club. It's a Republican, the
yes.
Metropolitan Republican Club. And what McGinnis was talking about, the subject of his speech, was to praise a young Japanese right-wing fanatic who attacked a Japanese socialist, I think it was the leader of the Japanese Socialist Party, with a samurai sword and killed him. And that's what they were commemorating. And that's why Gavin McGinnis
and
had
is a hero to them.
He had a samurai sword.
Throwing people from helicopters is joked about in certain segments of the fellow traveler alt-light community.
So, again, you wonder about why these people, the Proud Boys, aren't proud of their hateful ideology as opposed to trying to have it both ways. So what are we to make then of, let me ask you about your report, which is coming out soon. You do it every year, do you not, the Report to the Nation on Hate Crimes?
I don't even want to.
Right. Well, it's a rotten job.
But some inquiries.
Right. It's a rotten job. Somebody has to do it. So tell us about what's going to be in that report coming out in March, and particularly as it relates to hate crimes in Los Angeles.
Oh, and let me tell you something. This is not just a one-person thing. LAPD Hate Crime Unit has wonderful new leadership. They've been so extraordinarily helpful. I got PhDs at Cal State sending me emails at 3 in the morning. So this is like a team effort from some really good people. But overall, really interestingly, hate crimes in L.A. were up just a hair under 13% in 2018. This is the latest data available anywhere. So just up just about 13%, 12.9, from 256 in 2017 to 289. In 2018. And that's a decade high. So Los Angeles, though, big picture, joined Chicago, Sacramento, Washington, D.C., Houston, Dallas, and Seattle, among others, as having a decade high. And San Francisco, too, by the way. So, but not everybody's up. But interestingly enough, the last couple of years in L.A., there's been kind of a trade-off between gay males, who were the most targeted group in 2017, and African Americans. This year they flipped, although overall, all anti-gay crimes minus transgender was about flat, down slightly, but still more than anti-black. So bottom line is, Los Angeles, like some other cities, including Seattle and Washington, D.C., and Sacramento, have anti-gay male attacks being among the one or two most common. And in last year, just about first, give or take, depending on how you categorize it.
So is there a correlation, though, with the arrival of President Trump and an uptick in hate crimes? Because Charlottesville certainly made people focus on the idea that you know, the people that have been in the shadows have sort of crawled out from under a rock and now are strutting their stuff, as we saw in Charlottesville?
That is such a great – I love that question, because you know why? It enables me to touch on a bunch of stars in the social science constellation. We not only have hate crimes up in 2017, although interestingly, the data around Charlottesville for those particular days is not great, and a lot from that area, Charlottesville, was not registered. But Charlottesville itself did not show a big spike. But there's some issues with the data. But we did see spikes with respect to 2017, a 17% increase. There was also an increase with regard to some kind of hateful engagement on the Internet. So there's some great research that was published in Rolling Stone on that, and there are some other articles on that as well. So we saw in the run-up, as you were saying, Internet engagement, increase in hate crime. You know what else? We saw an more white nationalist mega rallies, these big rallies of over 100 or 200 people, in just the 2.5 years leading up to and just over Charlottesville before the alt-right imploded, than we did in the previous 10 to maybe 20 years. So bottom line is now, real briefly, in most of the cities we're looking at, we're seeing an increase in hate crime across many levels. Anti-Muslim, thankfully, is down. Anti-white is up. And anti-Semitic as well as anti-black up, though substantially less.
So the connection between the Proud Boys and Roger Stone, as a Republican operative who essentially was handed off by Roy Cohn to become Trump's, you know, dirty trickster opposition research guy. They have a very close relationship. We think that Mueller has actually, certainly in the raid that he just conducted, he's probably likely to get communications between the two. My understanding was that they spoke regularly throughout the campaign, even though Stone tries to say that he wasn't in regular communication with Trump through the campaign. The likelihood is that they were. So does this tie this new phenomenon closer to Trump himself?
You know, that is a great question, and it's one that I'm probably as empowered to answer as anyone else who's read whatever documents are public. But here's what I can say, and I think is actually very important. Let's give the president the benefit of the doubt. The fact of the matter is that many of these extremist groups, for the first time in decades, were behind a mainstream candidate. In 2012, I was on Hardball with Chris Matthews, and he said, who are these extremist groups, you know, to support? And I said, none of them. They're part of the system. President Trump's outsider status galvanized extremists on the far right in a way that we have not seen coalesce for some time. And that's why for the last couple of years, when we're looking at a variety of data points, whether it's hate homicides, whether it's internet engagement, or whether it's how these groups have gotten together and coalesced and got involved in politics, even if you look at the number of Nazis that have run for public office, there's a lot of data points. And what I'm saying to you is we've entered an era of nationalism, and part of that is going to be white nationalism. And where people like the Proud Boys fit in, there's this interesting nexus of kind of like taking back some kind of respect. Part of what they stand for is not really political, but cultural, a standing up for males who don't like the changes that are going on. And we've seen that in the past, 100 years ago with the Klan. They obviously hated African-Americans, but they were about prohibition and against the kind of jazz-era progressive change that was taking place. And I think that's a phenomenon that's not discussed as much, but it reeks in Gavin McGinnis's statement that was released today.
So how does beating up a black man or a gay man make you prouder? I mean, or make you recover from some sense of oppression? I don't see how there's a connection. If you want to be proud or people to be proud of you, then do something that you can be proud of and that others can recognize as something worthy of being proud of.
Yes, but they're not approaching it from the prism of your success. They're approaching it from people who are never respected, who are never listened to. They feel diminished, and they felt getting the short end of the stick with regard to institutions and bureaucracies. And one of the things that they liked about Trump that they didn't even understand about him is this important symbolism and this no-nonsense approach, and the fact that he can roil things up. the fact that he stands up. So part of this that I think is lost is that so much of this is symbolic. The wall, in many ways, is about a standing up for a certain kind of, what I wrote in the Daily Beast with Hussein Ibish a couple of years ago, Fortress America. Standing up for a country that has been sold by elitists and people who don't understand us. And that is a real appeal to people who feel that they're outsiders and haven't been heard and see changes going on that they fear.
So back to the lawsuit against the Southern Poverty Law Center by Gavin McGinnis, the founder of the Proud Boys, who's no longer with
them. Popcorn.
But he's no longer with them, but he's still suing on the basis that they've described his group, the Proud Boys, as a hate group, and he thinks that's actionable. And apparently he's been banned, as has Alex Jones, from Facebook and other various websites, including YouTube. And that's also, he's saying that's a direct consequence of being branded as a hate group. Again, you say you got the popcorn, you're not holding your breath that this is a serious lawsuit or one that's going to be treated seriously.
Well, you know, let's see what they have. And let me tell you something. As someone who's a lawyer, I just paid my bar dues. I got to tell you, you never want to take anything not serious. And what I'd like to see is more of what facts underlie their contentions. There's a lot of Cool Whip and not a lot of cream. You know what I mean? I mean it's big on bark, but not a lot on bite. The bottom line is, you know, what kind of damage to your reputation is there when people can take snippets of videos where he said the most horrible things and play it before a jury and, oh, get SPLC? And let me just tell you something about Richard Cohen. I love the guy to death. He's a hard general to work under, but arguably the most brilliant lawyer I've ever worked with. He would be like the last person I'd want to go to like small claims court with, let alone anything else. He's supremely brilliant and is really, I think, someone who, especially after what recently happened where they lost a suit. Well, they didn't lose a suit. They settled, rather. Excuse me. I think they're hyper careful. I think this is a call where, frankly, they have to win, and I think they will win, unless there's something that I don't know that's not public. But I think discovery is going to be killer for them.
Well, Brian Levin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian, as always. And remember, discovery is getting the evidence from the other side as you go into trial.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, he served as the associate director of the legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. And he's testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. And his forthcoming report to the nation, Hate Crimes, will be out in March. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved. The headline written down.